girl with a mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a saddening bore, for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall.
David Bowie, dead at the age of 69, was announced. We got the news this morning, right, as we woke up to that news overnight. It was released that by his family that he had passed away after an 18-month battle with cancer in New York City. Greg Kot, the great Chicago Tribune rock critic, is standing by. And, you know, David Bowie is a very, very hard guy, and you did an excellent job in the Trib today about this. He's a very hard act to properly defined because the scope is so great, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a guy who's you know, talk about genre experimentation, gender experimentation. I mean, he was if you liked one album, you know, watch out because the next one's going to be completely different. I mean, he was, you know, a chameleon, changing styles all the time. He was I really think he was the first postmodern rock star. I mean, in the past, the classic blues and country artists in the first couple of generations of rockers, they basically found a style, stuck with it. Bowie was all over the place. He was really experimenting with everything, and everything was on the table. And that really set, I mean, he was hugely influential. Subsequent generations of musicians have really used Bowie as a template for how to conduct their careers.
Deeply influenced, too. If you think about it, what he did is, he had certain sounds that he tried to create. There are things that he did, he co-wrote and co-produced that he may have even performed on, but were not his. There was the Mott the Hoople hit that he did, and which sounds just like him, but is, you know, because he wrote it, and it is that, but it was not him. There's also Iggy Pop. He worked with Iggy Pop on Lust for Life, which has been the theme of this show for many, many, many years. And other things, you know, his touch was in so many different places.
Oh, yeah, that's what I love about Bowie's career, is that he was so generous. Once he got a platform of fame, he didn't just use it, you know, for self-aggrandizement. I mean, it was obvious, you know, he loved it, but at the same time, he was using it to elevate his friends and heroes and inspirations. And you just mentioned a couple, you know, he basically resurrected Mott the Hoople's career by giving them All the Young Dudes. It was one of the best songs, you know, he had
of
ever
that
written.
Era.
And they had also tried to give them Suffragette City. They rejected that one, you know,
gosh,
which was probably in retrospect a little bit of a mistake, but they did okay with All the Young Dudes. You know, nobody knew who the Velvet Underground or Lou Reed was when Bowie produced Lou Reed's Transformer album and Take a Walk on the Wild Side. I mean, that was his doing. That was Bowie's saxophone solo at the end of that song. You know, Iggy Pop, again, the Stooges, you know,
Queen,
vastly underappreciated band, and Bowie taking Pop under his wing and giving him two of his, you know, those great solo albums, Lust for Life and The Idiot. And Pop sent this amazing tweet today. You know, he's had a long and illustrious career, thanks to Bowie's tutelage in a lot of ways, mentorship, you know, saying he was the light of my life. You know, and for an unsentimental guy like Iggy to say that about some person was pretty unique. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it's a lovely part of Bowie's legacy, was the way that he expanded the careers of so many great artists that otherwise would not have been known had Bowie not, you know, drawn attention to them.
There's a great video circulating, or has resurfaced, of Bowie trying to convince, or talk about how he tried to convince MTV to feature more black artists, too, at that time when he felt there wasn't a good representation of him. Just another example of using his platform to help others in the music industry.
We know, I think a lot of that, and Greg, I know you mentioned this in your article today, but I think a lot of that comes from the incredible success that he had with Let's Dance, which was a phenomenal pop record of its day, right in the wheelhouse of that sort of confluence of that new romantic kind of movement plus dance music.
Mm-hmm.
And he produced it with Nile Rodgers from Chic.
Right.
And Nile Rodgers really became, you know, he's one of the great record producers of all time. So it's just a fascinating thing that, you know, he dipped his incredible talent down into something that, you know, I don't think anybody expected that album when that came out.
No.
Wouldn't you agree?
No, it was definitely one aspect of it was that he was reaching for the pop charts, but then again, collaborating with somebody like Nile Rodgers, who was coming out of the disco world. I mean, you remember? I mean, we're in the home of disco sucks, right?
Yeah.
Quote unquote.
Yeah.
Horrible time in the city in terms of just a divide, you know, a racially, I might add, I think. And you know, the whole point with Bowie was that no, these are styles of music that deserve our attention and gratitude. You know, he embraced Donna Summer, Giorgio Moroder, that Euro disco stuff in the 70s in a big way. You know, Luther Vandross, you know, was all over the Young Americans record. Nobody knew who Luther Vandross was. He was this 19th singer, and Bowie took this guy up and said, you know, do five songs in the middle of my show. And Vandross was like, everybody's booing me, and what should I do? He said, no, you're doing your thing, man, and keep doing it. And, you know, the next decade, Vandross is one of the biggest R&B stars on the planet. But Bowie, again, you know, taking a chance on something that, you know, rock stars didn't typically do, sort of going that far outside the margins of what rock was considered in that era.
You know, he was so multifaceted, Greg, that as I was reading more and more about him, you know, today, as people were talking about him on social media, I didn't realize he had basically his own internet service, apparently. Before Instagram, YouTube, or Twitter ever existed, he had his BowieNet, where you could get exclusive content and get an email address with Bowie, davidbowie.com or something as your, you know, suffix. I think mm-hmm. I mean, he seemed like ahead of his time in that and so many other things.
Yeah, you know, I retweeted somebody today on Twitter, a fan who really put it well, something to the effect of, you know, I really hope, you know, Bowie gets bored of death and comes back, because it was kind of like that one. It was that kind of thing where Bowie was constantly, you know, he was always on to the next thing, because he would have been, you know, he would have died from stasis. You know, that was the worst thing to him, staying pat, doing the same thing over and over again. You know, he would change his set list. There were times where he would stop performing his greatest hits. You know, he formed a band called Tin Machine that nobody seemed to like except Bowie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just all in the spirit of, I need to keep changing up and I need to keep moving, otherwise I die creatively.
And an artist like Bowie is about, you have to be at that level to be able to get away with that and
sure.
not be roundly despised for doing it, you know?
Or I mean, rejected.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, in this world where you talk about branding and everyone has sort of a personal brand, and he seemed to be changing it in some way. That almost became his brand, this constant change and, you know, multiple personalities, as he put it.
Well, I want to go back to something here. Hold on one second, because I want to play this for you. This is him talking about the internet and technology. And when we're done with this, Greg, you might have already seen or quoted this today, but I will ask you the year in which he said this.
Ruh-roh.
I don't think we've even seen the tip of the iceberg. I think the potential of what the internet is going to do to society, both good and bad, is unimaginable. I think we're actually on the cusp of something exhilarating and terrifying.
Ooh.
2000.
Well,
2000 was the year. And,
yeah.
And this was way before the, you know, that explosion. People were just using the internet
mm-hmm.
as, you know, for, they had AOL. Your computer was still saying, it was welcoming you every morning when you were waking up. You know,
right.
You know, this is a
Google
very
was founded at the end of 98. That puts it in perspective.
Right. I mean, he's
right.
and he's on, he's getting that the world is changing. And what a perfect voice to talk about that, because people, I think a lot of people, like when I was a kid, I thought he was from the future.
Yeah, he certainly gave off that aura, like, you know, I'm not part of your parents' generation. I may not even be part of your generation. You know, I am what your generation will become. And, you know, that was awe-inspiring to so many people to see this guy being completely himself, having no regard for what people considered normal or what they considered safe or what they considered correct. And he was moving beyond that. And it's amazing that so many of the innovations he came up with, musical, cultural, the way, you know, a man could dress, the whole idea of gender freedom, you know, the whole idea that sexuality could be fluid. I mean, all those things seem so radical and strange and off-putting when he started doing these kind of things on a mainstream level now seem very normal and very much accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying he's the only guy that did that, but he certainly played a huge role in it because of the platform he had, that people were paying attention to him.
You know, and it was not an overnight success either. That's something that I think needs to be pointed out. In the 1960s, he struggled, first of all, because he was Davy Jones, in a number of different bands, and he was trying different genres. Blues was, you know, sort of the dominant one through the mid-1960s. And he was having trouble really catching traction. So in his eponymous first album, in which Space Oddity, you know, was the single off of that, and it was released a couple days before the Apollo 11 landing on the moon,
mm-hmm.
and it took off as a result of that, I think in part because of that, and it became a theme for the space program, for NASA, essentially,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, it's funny because, like, the BBC wouldn't play the track until the Apollo landed safely back on Earth. You know, they thought it was a crass marketing move on Bowie's part, which it probably was.
It was, yeah, no question.
But, you know, at the same time, it was an incredibly beautiful, poignant track, and you know, it sort of defined him. You know, here's Major Tom. Here's the first of my many characters, you know, mm-hmm. many guises that I would be in. And it would be a recurring figure throughout his career. You know, he would come back to it occasionally. You know, it's kind of, hey, what's Major Tom up to these days? You know, in Ashes to Ashes, he was a junkie, you know, and a tragic junkie. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that Bowie was so... He jump-started his career any way he could. You know, he was one of those guys that had something to say, and he wanted to be noticed for it. And some people say he was exploitive, and he was, you know, he was doing these things strictly for marketing reasons. But then we look back on the music, and my God, does it hold up? You know, it's not like it was a trinket or a fad or a gadget. You know, you look at some tracks that were gimmicks
mm-hmm.
20 years ago, and like Kung Fu Fighting sounds really horrible now. You know, it's not like
hey!
You know, they're running a trend, and it's like you don't want to be, you don't want to hear it again.
Everybody was a kung fu fighting.
And they wanted to forget.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
Now, I will say this, though. The other thing he touched, and I think he changed, and people don't quite understand this about Saturday Night Live. When Saturday Night Live first went on the air, and they would do the two music, you know, the musical act, and then they would do, you know, two songs is what they got. Sometimes they got three, I think, in the first couple seasons. And Lorne Michaels was a genius about this. He wanted them to do a song no one had heard up first, and then do the hit as the second song, so mm-hmm. that they would do what they were going to do. But they were pretty standard acts and pretty standard performances.
Mm-hmm.
Bowie right. comes along. And Bowie does a thing where he's sitting in a, you know, he's like standing in a trash can. It's a Ziggy Stardust kind of, you know, get up and the whole thing. And now all of a sudden, avant-garde becomes part of it's an arrow in the quiver of Saturday Night Live for music. And that gets you to all these places and all those bands that Saturday Night Live broke or created, or when Kanye wanted to change what he was doing, where'd he go? He went to Saturday Night Live to do it. You know, it's like, that's all sort of predicated on the success that Bowie had in that genre.
Yeah, he was. You knew he was a provocateur when you booked him for something like that. You knew it was going to be a one of a kind performance that you would talk about for days, just because it was so mind blowing visually. And I loved that as a kid, you know, seeing these new Bowie incarnations. I mean, I don't think people now can appreciate just how shocking a lot of this stuff was, especially to, you know, people like your parents.
On network television,
like,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
oh, my God.
What the hell is that?
Yeah, yeah. And that what the hell is that is the stuff that changes your world. You know, you get shaken by it when you're at a certain age, and you never forget it, and it influences you and influences how you see the world. And back then, it's interesting that, you know, everybody thought the world was going to end because of people like Bowie, and now we realize that this is the world he has created. In a lot of ways, it's a better, more tolerant place because of people like Bowie. He opened people's minds, and I think that was a huge, huge, you know, underlining aspect to his entire career.
He's not only has got all these great, wild kinds of, you know, insurgencies and things that he did into the culture, But then he also has one of the most played Christmas songs with Bing Crosby on Christmas radio, which
is awesome.
I mean, think about that. It just tells you about the talent, you know, his vocal talent and all the rest of that.
Well, and that was coming from a sincere place. He really did admire, you know, crooners like Crosby, who preceded him. This was something that he had a genuine affection for that music. It was in his house, you know, when he was growing up. You know, similarly for, you know, a theatrical performer like Anthony Newley, early on he was imitating Anthony Newley with the kind of inflections that he was using on some of his ballads. So this wasn't kind of like, oh, I'm going to go hang out with this, you know, older generation artist to expand my audience. No, it came from a place of genuine affection and appreciation for what Crosby had done. You know, the whole idea of using the microphone as an instrument, I mean, before Crosby came along, that really wasn't a commonplace thing that pop singers did, but Crosby sort of revolutionized the art of singing, and a guy like Bowie was smart enough to recognize that, you know, decades later, that it had ultimately an influence on the way he approached his music.
Yeah.
What about the final album, Greg? Have you heard about this? Released 2 days before his birthday, a couple days ago. I mean, have you listened to it? There's been a lot of. I mean, I guess there's a little bit out there about it, and maybe what statement he's trying to make here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, oddly enough, the review of that album appeared in the paper this morning, and it was online a few days ago when the album came out that I wrote. But I loved it. I thought it was another example of his music being stretched. He was one of those guys who, he walks into a New York City jazz bar a couple of years ago and sees this great jazz quartet, Donny McCaslin's quartet, and hires them to be his band for this record. So he was exploring new terrain. Even to the very end, he was changing up the game and making a record that didn't sound like any other record in his discography, which is, I think, exactly the way the guy wanted to go out. This was all obviously carefully planned in a lot of ways, because I think David knew that he was going to be making much more music after this. But it was a beautiful statement, a beautiful parting gift from a great artist.
We'll play a little bit of that on the other side. Greg, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg.
Work in the Tribune today, and the Tribune Online, actually, where you've got that story about him. And how, I mean, this is a shock to everybody. So how quickly you were able to kind of, were you already sort of aware that this would be a problem?
No, I had no idea. I think there was such a carefully guarded secret. I woke up this morning into the news and that he had died, and, you know, got right on it. I basically wrote everything from scratch this morning. This is getting really to be a sad duty. I mean, Otis Clay died over the weekend. Right. Lemmy from Motorhead died a few days ago around Christmas, and these obits are starting to pile up, and this was a really tough one, but we tried to do him justice.
You did. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Appreciate it
very much, guys. It was fun talking to you.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, the Tribune. Go to tribune.com.
So good.
For that today. It's amazing. It's really, really well done. Probably the best, so far the best thing I've read about this all day.